Hello, I'm Ross Camage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, challenges and triumphs of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science across the whole spectrum of life's experiences. And joining me today is someone who I think really exemplifies the idea of, you know, the big picture view of oncology, and that's Mike Kelly. Mike, would you like to introduce yourself in any way that you see fit?
Yeah, thanks, Ross, for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you. So I have three titles, so I'll start in that way. My professional titles are a professor of medicine at Duke University. I'm also the chief of hematology and oncology at the Durham VA Medical Center. And my third role is as the executive director of the National Oncology Program for the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Wow, so lots to dig into there. But let's start with a little bit of sort of the David Copperfield. How did Mike Kelly end up at Duke and the VA? And somewhere along the way, we're going to have to explain what on earth the VA is to anyone who's not an American listening.
Yes, we could certainly do that. So VA stands for Veterans Affairs. I first came to Duke right out of medical school. I matched here for internal medicine residency. I guess there's a little bit of a story behind that because I interviewed at, you know, 10 places, and Duke actually is my first ranked one. When I was in medical school, I was told that I wasn't quite on the A-list, but Duke was a good B-list school. So I thought, okay, I'll come down and check it out. And it was the new Department of Medicine chair's first recruiting class I was in. I happened to also be with his daughter, who was one of my colleagues for 3 years in internal medicine. But you know, I just felt really at home at Duke. When I visited, I think they were the only institution that I was interviewing with that really reached out to me after the interview to express their interest in me. And so I came down. That was how I got here.
I think you told me you grew up in kind of the boonies in Michigan.
I grew up in southeastern Michigan, which I wouldn't say is the boonies. There are much more rural areas in Michigan than where I grew up, but it is a small place. Population is about 20,000 now. It's a small town called Monroe, Michigan. It was settled by the French initially in the 1600s, was a site of a, in quotes, massacre in the War of 1812. Remember the Raisin?
Oh, wow.
It was the home of George Custer, General George Custer. And there's a statue near the main intersection of him on a horse.
That's pretty cool. They're not going to tear that one down.
Well, my father wanted to send it to his birthplace, but I don't think that was what the town leaders wanted to do, yeah.
And I think you told me this, your dad was a lawyer, but wanted to have been a doctor?
Yeah, so he was actually a judge, too. So he became a judge later in his career, so he was pretty well known in the town. Of course, the town wasn't very, very big. But I came from a family of lawyers, so his father was a lawyer, and there are several other lawyers that going back on different sides of the family. Both my brothers are lawyers. I have a sister who's a paralegal, but I chose the medicine route. Not sure how that happened. I think maybe I was attracted more to science and less to the written word and speech. So I guess that's how I ended up thinking more and talking less.
Your medical school was University of Michigan?
That's correct.
I love the comment about, you know, well, you're a B-team person. I remember when I went to school and the headmaster called me into his office when I was considering applying to Oxford and Cambridge. And he said, you know, you're good, but you're not great. Unfortunately, that one sentence has remained with me throughout my life. But, you know, you do what you can. In Duke, tell me about the language barrier moving from the north to the south.
I wouldn't call it a barrier. It's quite quaint. The accents here were disappearing when I first came here. There were, I think, many people who were moving from the northeast, and some of the locals were intentionally trying to get rid of their accents, but there are some terms which are used in this part of the country which are not, I would say, standard in many other parts of the country. And some of them are medically related. So first of all, there's different forms of non-steroidal agents. So here there's goody powders, which is a form of acid.
It's a street drug.
That was one example. And then you didn't have tendons, you had leaders. So you'd have a pain on the leader. And then there's some other terms. I do remember there was a thank you card that had been sent to the hospital ward where I was working, and it was addressed to Duke Hospital, Durham, North Carolina. Durham was spelled D-E-R-M. The fact that it got to there, I thought was a blessing.
Like phonetically written.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, so there are some examples where you don't lose consciousness, you fall out. You don't pass out, you fall out.
Wow, that's cool. And then, so after your residency, you then, I think, took a fairly academic track. So was that always in your mind, or was there a kind of epiphany where you went, yeah, I want to go head to a lab?
I was very interested in research and wet research, so sort of basic science research from the very beginning. As an undergrad, I'd worked in a yeast lab, and then in medical school, did a little bit of work with southern blotting. Anyone remembers that technique? They're looking at DNA hybridization on gels with radioactivity. And then it was considering the MD PhD program and decided not to do that. I think that was something I went back and forth on, whether that was necessary or not. In the end, I went to do internal medicine, and I actually chose that because I thought the research opportunities were greater there. But when I got into residency, I was really missing the laboratory. So I decided that I would go to the NIH, and not in the clinical program, but in a basic science lab.
And then did that mean you essentially divorced yourself from the clinic for a period of time and you were just pure science?
That's correct. I had no formal clinical training or responsibilities for 2 years while I was doing this sort of postdoc. The titles of what people do at NIH is sometimes difficult to interpret, but I think it was called the medical staff fellow. What it, medical part of it was that I had an MD after my name. There's no patient responsibilities, but I did end up going to the clinical center, which is the hospital at the NIH, and saw patients in the clinic there, because after a year, I started to miss the clinical work as well and just wanted to remain connected. But I wasn't committed to doing oncology or any particular specialty at that point. I had been completely undifferentiated when I left residency.
How long were you at the NIH? Because you then transitioned into kind of clinical, like oncology training at the NIH?
Yeah, so I was there for a total of a little over 10 years. So I went there and was in a basic science lab, so Stu Aronson's lab, for 2 years. Worked on, you know, oncogenes and some cell signaling and an equine virus, and then went to do the fellowship program there. So they had medical oncology only fellowship. That's what I did, and that was for 3 years. But it was really 1 year of clinical training, and then you had a longitudinal clinic, and mostly you did research. So it was very minimal clinical duties in the second and third year. And so that got me in halfway. So I was 5 years in. And at the end of that, I stayed on as, you know, another title that no one can interpret. And I can't even remember what it meant now. I was basically between fellowship and junior faculty and sort of transitioning with increasing responsibilities. But mostly I did research. I loved being in that environment. There were plenty of resources and an endless stream of questions to try to work.
Do you know, one of the fun things is about going through someone's CV and going sort of, you know, back in time. I've got to ask you this question. Okay, so one of your early publications, you know, Kelly et al., was on some kind of keratinocyte gene in what was called the great ape radiation. And I have no idea what that means. It just, I wish I had a publication with great ape radiation written on it.
That was the first publication that I wrote. I mean, that was a challenge to write that, because I really hadn't had formal training on how to write a scientific paper. I actually went to the National Zoo to look at all the great apes because I didn't know what a gibbon was. that was part of my research, was to go to the zoo.
Oh, it's a hard life as a scientist.
Yeah. So the story is that the keratinocyte growth factor, it does have some therapeutic utility that don't have to go into right now, but it is a small molecule, and the receptor for that molecule is a tyrosine kinase. So it's similar to FGFR or EGFR or MET and RET and all this whole family of tyrosine kinase transmembrane receptors. So the keratinocyte growth factor is the ligand for that, or one of the ligands for it. And the lab was studying that. They had isolated the protein and were characterizing it, and I was working on the gene. And as I started to look for homologs of it, so basically coming back to southern blotting, where you do not stringent hybridization, but you do low stringency hybridization. You look for things that are similar in sequence, but not identical. The first blot that I did in humans, it showed up all these bands. And the postdoc who was supervising me and working with me at that time said, okay, what did you do wrong? And so I did it again. And of course, I got exactly the same answer. And it turns out that there are a lot of pseudogenes for that particular gene that encodes the keratinocyte growth factor. And we're like, okay, that's kind of interesting. But what was the story? And so the story was, well, mouse didn't look like that. So when did humans get all these extra copies? And what was the mechanism of that? Or what was the significance of any? So I didn't get to the end of all those questions because I ran out of time. But we did show that the multiplication of those sequences occurred late in evolution and the global sense of evolution. So it happened during the great ape radiation. So this was when all the great apes were breaking up. So you see multiple copies in chimps and gorillas, but not in gibbons and not in orangutan.
So old world and new world apes.
Well, no, that's a little bit different. So this is the great apes are all old world. Well, they really aren't in that at all. But the gorillas, chimpanzees, and humans sort of diverged more recently, and then the orangutans and gibbons came up before them. And there were some estimates as to what the time was and when that happened. And then later, when the whole genome got sequenced, then we understood.
So did you just go and buy gorilla DNA, you know, off Sigma, or did you actually have to go to the zoo and beg a piece of tissue?
That is a great question, too. So my lab chief, so Stu Aronson, knew someone who was at Fort Detrick in Frederick, Maryland. And so I went up there and talked to him, and he opened up his freezer and said, here's some DNA from gibbons. And so I don't think he had DNA. I think he had tissue. And then I isolated the DNA. It gave him most of the DNA and used a little bit of it.
That's pretty cool. Back to the main story. That was a fascinating diversion. You're just 10 years in the NIH machine, which is this kind of like bubble of expertise. What made you then say, okay, it's time to leave? Because I remember one of my colleagues here is like, yeah, I think if you work for the NIH for something like 20 years, you get some full pension. And so the question is like, are you in for 20 years or do you leave early? And it sounds like, you know, you took a different path.
Okay, so let me explain that 20 years. So there's the Public Health Service, which is a uniform service of the United States. So it has the same retirement system, the same employment system, or an analogous employment system as the military. So all the branches of the military and a couple other uniform services of the United States that we don't have to talk about today. But that is 20 years. So if you have 20 years of service in the uniform service, then you can retire with full benefits, essentially, or almost full benefits. And I think you do get more if you keep staying in up to 30. So I was a civil servant when I first went to the NIH for 2 years. And then the employment mechanism for my fellowship then became the uniform service. Yeah. What I was told was that the reason they did that is because it cost the program less.
It wouldn't surprise me.
I'm like, okay, it doesn't matter to me. But it did have some implications that I had to buy a uniform. But in any case, that really didn't play into that decision to leave. So I was happy with what I was doing, but I did want to be on the tenure track because that is a thing. So that if you are on a tenure track, then you actually get to undergo these what are called site visits. You can be the lead of the research group, which there are all kinds of different names for. And you know that would be the progression of a professional type that you would want, and I want. So they created a tenure track position eventually and advertised that, and I applied, but I wasn't selected.
Yeah.
So at that point, I thought that I needed to leave, and I think they thought I needed to leave too, which was quite challenging, right? Because I'd been there for a decade. I had some connections to the community, but more importantly is I had never written. Actually, it's not entirely true. I had actually written some grants and actually been awarded them, but not from NIH or any of the government funding agency, but from private sources.
Is that because when you're in the NIH, correct me if I got the wrong term, but the intramural system, the money just flows, maybe not terribly well, but at least it flows without you having to apply for a grant.
That was the way it worked for me because I wasn't the branch chief and I wasn't the senior investigator. So the money was just there and you could just use it. And there were these site visits. So every 4 years, you would kind of go through a retrospective look at what you produced and your plans for the future. And it was a scientific review. It was done by external scientists who, you know, came and talked to you in person. There was a lot of funding that, and it was quite generous in my opinion.
Yeah.
I wasn't trying to do big things. I was doing my own little things. And it is the intramural program. So the extramural program, you apply for a grant and it goes through peer review. This is what I think all your listeners will be very familiar with. And it's really the way it works in most places of the world. But that was something that I did not have a lot of experience doing. Anyway, so that was somewhat stressful. But anyway, so I looked around at a couple different places and had a few different offers, but decided that what I felt most comfortable with and where I felt that both personally and professionally, I could continue to be successful was back at Duke. And so I was happy to come back.
And what sort of position were you looking for? You're looking for a kind of lab clinic hybrid at that point?
Yeah, I was looking for the traditional 80-20. You know, I'd been told several times that I was on the B team. So
I'd love to have you on my B team.
It's good for everyone to, you know, to get some honest feedback, and it can be painful, but I think it did help me in the end to understand how I could contribute and find my place in the world. I hope that's true for your listeners too, is that no matter what you hear from colleagues or peer reviewers on your manuscript reviews, there is a place for you in the research community and in medicine in general, and you just have to find that place.
When you had that transition point, as it were, from the NIH and then heading towards Duke, you know, what was going on in your life? Were you married? Did you have kids at that point?
Oh, yeah. I was married, had 4 kids.
So big deal for moving.
It wasn't just me packing up and getting into the U-Haul. There was a lot of logistics. My wife had a job, so that was another consideration. Of course, all the kids were in school. And this transition was happening in the middle of the academic year. So that was some disruption for the kids. But it was fine. You know, we did have some family in North Carolina. So my wife's cousin lives about 30 minutes away from where we ended up. So that was okay. It was a big change, I think, for everyone. But everyone was good-natured about it. And it was partly an adventure. I remember when we were looking at houses or visiting the area with my kids, and they would find coins on the ground. And so the joke became that the roads of North Carolina are paved with gold.
Did you seed the coins before you went? That's a brilliant strategy if you hadn't done it.
No, yeah, I don't think we did. I think it just happened that they just found things that were shiny.
That's cool. How did you meet your wife?
I met her in South Lecture Hall at the University of Michigan in pharmacology class.
And what does she do for a living, other than bringing up 4 kids?
Yeah, so she's a doctor of pharmacy. So she got a PharmD degree from the University of Michigan, and we graduated the same year. And so she's not working now, but she worked for part of the time that we were raising kids.
So first official faculty appointment on the track that other people might recognize without the weird NIH titles. And I think you told me you were about 39, 40 when that started as your assistant professor.
Yeah, I was 39. Yeah, not 40.
It was very important. A 1 year difference is very important. You told me this great story about how they recruited you with, you know, the promise of, you know, one day my son, all of this will be yours. And then even that plan changed before you arrived.
Yes. So I was interested in lung cancer. I was at the NIH with John Minna. I overlapped with him for a period of time, and Eddie Gazdar. So your listeners that know the lung cancer gurus of yesteryear would recognize both those names. I was working directly with Bruce Johnson. John Minna and Eddie Gesner left before I had was leaving, and Bruce was on his way out the door around that time, or maybe even before that. But I had, you know, looked for a position that I could continue to work in lung cancer because that's where I felt comfortable most clinically and in research. And I was lucky to be recruited by Duke, and they were interested in expanding their lung cancer program. And in particular, Gerald Bepler was here, who actually had been at the NCI before me. And so we had, you know, crossed paths before. And he and another investigator and I were targeted to be co-located at a wing of the research building at the VA hospital, which is directly across the street from the Duke Medical Center and integrated with it quite nicely. I had been at both institutions before and knew that it was a simple walk across the street, and so was totally fine with that arrangement. And was glad everything was all hunky-dory. I signed on the line, and I would say not the next day, but probably within a week, I got a call from Gerald, and he says, yeah, I'm leaving. So he was destined for greater things. Gave him great respect for that. He was here when I arrived, but he left shortly thereafter and never moved his research program over to the VA. So I was on a hall that was big enough for three labs, and I was one small lab just sort of starting out. So it was pretty lonely for a while. That building has no windows at all.
Well, this is like a prison. Many VAs do look like prisons, I got to say.
Yeah, they have that nice brick, that nice government brick color. There are some really beautiful VAs, so I shouldn't say that's not universal, but it was built on a very tight budget, and they said, okay, no windows, and it's all cinder block. But, that wasn't important to me. What was important to me was that I had the environment in which to still prosper, and I made the use of everything that I had. So I had colleagues, two floors down from me, were very good, and I walked across the street and participated in a lot of the activities at Duke. So it did change. It was different, but I was here and I was going to make it work.
This would be a great time to try and explain to the audience exactly what the VA is and this idea that you've got a job at Duke, but you've got your lab at the VA, and educate us.
Yeah. Okay. So again, VA stands for Veterans Affairs. It's a department of the U.S. government. So there are a number of different departments like Treasury, State, Department of Defense, and one of them is called Department of Veterans Affairs. It's actually a relatively young department. I think it was from the late 80s even. So it's relatively new, but the VA has been around for much longer than that. And it's called the Veterans Administration, I think, before that. And it does three things primarily. So it does healthcare, it does benefits, and it does cemeteries. And its motto comes from actually President Lincoln, who I think in the Gettysburg Address, but sometime during the Civil War, said that it's our duty to take care of the veteran and his widow and orphan. And there's a quote on the main building in Washington, D.C. with that title. So what the VHA, so the Veterans Health Administration, is I think what most people think of when they think of the VA. Yeah. It is a large integrated healthcare system in the United States, and it has about somewhere between 18 and 20 million enrollees. So it's a big fraction of the population of the United States. It might be maybe 3.5% of the entire population, 3 to 3.5%. And we have about 3 to 3.5% of the cancers in the country. There are 170 some medical centers and probably 1,000 clinics, over 1,000 different sites of care. It's paid for by tax dollars. It's a single payer and a single provider system. So it has some analogies to the national health system from the UK and most developed countries in the world that have a nationalized health system. It has some similarities. There's complete integration. So everyone has a primary care physician. VA doesn't provide all the services because we can't be everywhere for everyone. Our population is spread all over the country. We're actually distributed in rural areas to a much greater degree than the population as a whole. So about 14% of United States citizens live in rural areas, but there's about a third, so really around 33-34% of veterans that are enrolled in VA live in rural areas. So we have a lot of challenges in terms of the geographic reach that we have to reach. And one of the things that we do is we have a great telehealth program. The way that the VA, after the Second World War, when a lot of veterans were getting out of the service and the VA services were getting ramped up, they realized that the health system needed to have some strategic location of their facilities next to medical centers in order to make use of the expertise by in small pieces of experts rather than by a whole neurosurgeon at a facility they can buy an eighth. Okay. And that's the way VA still talks about physician times is an eighth. Oh, we only have this many patients. We only need to hire you for two eighths of you. that was a very strategic and I think great approach. And so the Veterans Health Administration, the three missions are education. So about 3/4 of all physicians in the United States have either worked for the VA or have been trained in the VA.
Wow.
And so everybody knows the VA, but nobody knows the VA because they're usually here for a short period of time and get some training and then leave. So education, healthcare, and research. And so that's why the other advantage of being co-located with medical centers allowed the research mission to also prosper. And then the fourth mission we actually saw recently during the COVID pandemic is just to provide public health services during emergencies. And that was actually activated. So some of our staff are usually having some training, but this was a completely different thing. So during that, we were all told during the pandemic is we may have to send you somewhere.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and I don't think anybody got sent anywhere. I think they asked for volunteers, and people do travel occasionally during hurricanes and other types of natural disasters. But the pandemic really showed that the VA does have that fourth role. But anyway, but most people think of it in terms of the healthcare system, and the academic researchers understand it from the opportunity to apply for grants. So it has its own grant funding mechanisms. So if you have an idea that is applicable to veterans, then that would be an opportunity.
The job you got, was it split between Duke and the VA, or was it all at the VA when you first started?
I have two jobs. So I have a Duke job and a VA job, and I've had that ever since I've been here. I get two paychecks.
Nice.
Well, neither one of them is very big.
It's two small paychecks. And so your lab's in the VA, and that sounds like it has certain advantages because there's specific funding streams you can get through that. Is that only if your lab is located at the VA, or can I be at a university unaffiliated with the VA and apply for VA funds?
So you can now apply for a VA grant, but if you get the grant, then you have to have at least 5 ACE effort at the VA. So yeah. The medical center has to commit to hiring you at that rate.
Okay.
It used to be that you couldn't even apply until you had that 5 ACE.
Okay. You know, you're back in a clinical role. Were you seeing patients again on both sides of the street or just at the VA?
I have only ever seen patients at the VA. So all my clinical effort has always been at the VA.
Were you in 80-20? Did you stick to that model?
There's no 80-20 really, right? So
it's a fantasy.
It's 80-20 on paper, and it might be 70-30 or 60-40. And it started to slip almost immediately. But there were some years when I was pretty close to that, when I really did stick to that quite closely. That evolved pretty continuously, I think, and there were some episodic bumps in that ratio, or I guess maybe decrements in that ratio. So that happened when I started to take on administrative duties. One of the things that I saw was that the VA didn't have really good leadership, and even in my little part of it in hematology oncology, there was a commitment to actually being here and for the long term. And if there's one thing that doesn't work in the VA, it's coming in quickly and telling the VA how to change.
Yeah.
So if you want to make change in a large organization, a little longer term, unless you're the CEO of a company and you can just tell everyone that we're going to do something different, that commitment was important to ensuring that my research was successful and I was able to have good colleagues to work with, take care of the patients, and that the clinical operation got the care and feeding that it needed.
That's my impression, both from your CV and actually from the time that you and I have interacted. You know, you may have been on the B team in some people's eyes, but one of the things that, really emerged later was your skill in, large organizations and leadership and, seeming to do the right thing and caring about the people under your wing, as it were. And I've always been impressed by that. But I mean, maybe that's looking back in retrospect with kind of rose-tinted glasses. But were you initially attracted to these administrative roles, or were they kind of like, hi, Mike, you're volunteered?
First, I have to say, Ross, well, I've really hoodwinked you, boy. Because I'm still on the B team in everyone's eyes.
Well, not in my eyes, but there we go.
Yeah, I've been told that up and down, even in all the administrative times too. So I don't like administrative duties. I like organizational stability and making sure that the mission is supported in a way that it can be successful. So I'm willing to do the hard work if it's going to be successful at creating an environment which will be positive in the long run. So, and that's true in almost any area of my life. So I'm not afraid to roll up my sleeves and understand how the sausage is made and try to improve the workflows, advocate for the resources that are needed in order to put the patients in the room so the doctors don't have to put the patients in the room and take the vital signs and this kind of thing. So I think anyone who's practicing the VA in, at some setting has seen that the physicians are often, especially the academic medical centers, are really outstanding, but there aren't enough staff oftentimes. And now I think that's largely because we can't hire enough staff. Not that we don't have the positions, but VA just can't hire enough people fast enough right now. But that still doesn't solve the problem is, you know, I need someone to fax this or, you know, hey, can you give this patient an injection? I think when I viewed the clinical operation, I was in clinic. I was just one of the minions seeing patients, the lung cancer patients primarily, and doing my rotations and educating the fellows and the residents and students. But I saw that there really needed to be some longitudinal commitment to what I was doing, what was being done in VA where I am, or there no one was going to listen because you can't just ask once at the VA. You have to ask three times once every year, and then you get what you ask for.
So, I mean, in a, you know, in kind of geological time, in a relatively short space of time, like 7 or 8 years, you become essentially the head of the whole cancer program for the VA across the country. You know, you gave your title executive director of national blah 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 blah, but I mean that's it. You are in charge of cancer for the VA.
Yeah, there's a story behind that too. So
it's like everyone sit down who doesn't want the job. Mike, you're it.
Well, it was so I applied for that job, but the story is that Congress was going to be evaluating VA's oncology program. And the person who was running the oncology program was a nephrologist. And so they said, oh, we should probably get an oncologist.
Yeah, I love the way they think.
It was efficiency, right? They had one person who was running three different areas. It was a central office position. They weren't really doing much other than, I don't know what they were doing. But anyway, so they said, okay, we should probably hire an oncologist and here are the characteristics that we need. Someone put that in front of me and I talked to a bunch of different people about, okay, what is this role and what's it like? My chief of staff at the VA told me, yeah, I think this is one of those positions where you're on a lot of phone calls, but you don't have to listen very closely. And so you can do some work while you're listening. I'm like, I'll go and interview. So I went up to DC and interviewed. They asked me some questions and I'm like, I'm a scientist. I don't know the answer to that question.
Were these politicians interviewing you? Is it a political appointment?
These were administrators, people who were administrating the VA, not politicians. I didn't bump into those till much later. So they offered me a position and I said, yeah, I really don't want this. And then the chief guy called me up and said, you know, this would be really good. Here are some of the other people who've accepted the position, similar positions in other disease areas. And then when I looked up those people, I thought, okay, this might be a good group of colleagues to work with. And it turned out that my initial impression was it was great. They brought in thought leaders of healthcare delivery and health systems, things that I'd never thought of before, but you know, gave me a foundation for what great medicine should look like. And it totally ripped the wheels off of everything that we do in the United States, in my opinion, because the models don't come from the United States, or it's not all of them came from the United States. There are others, right? There's Kaiser Permanente.
Yeah.
And Intermountain Health has some characteristics of that. And then there's the Department of Defense, but really it's the VA that is the model for what is a single payer, single provider system in the United States. And it really has a characteristic that when you boil it down to it, it's the healthcare system that we all want. If you describe the healthcare system that you would want to have for yourselves, you come really close to what the VA has.
It's funny because as a you know, born again American and sort of having to learn the politics of when I got here. The people who are often most in favor of the VA are also the people who are most adamant about there not being socialized medicine. And it's like, but the VA is, maybe socialized is just a dirty word, but it's the same principle. It's, you know, free at the point of delivery. It's based on, you know, need rather than ability to pay. And it's equitable. I'm sure there are other buzzwords that you're supposed to throw in.
I could turn around and say it's family values, right? It's taking care of each other.
Yeah.
That is what family values is. And that is what the VA healthcare system is about. At the core of it, that is the same principle. So call it whatever you want. The characteristics that it has is that you have a unified healthcare system. You have a unified electronic health record system. You have relatively low copays, but you don't get everything you want. You get the things that are effective, that improve how long you live, how the quality of life that you have when you're living, and hopefully with as few costs and toxicities as possible. There's actually a book out there about the best healthcare anywhere, I think that's the title of it. It was a reporter who was asked to write on that topic and didn't know where he was going to end up, and ended up at the VA. I looked at my own healthcare systems and my wife's and everything else, and went through it in a business approach to whether the characteristics and who can deliver on those characteristics. And there are many, many studies that look at quality of care in VA versus non-VA. And the VA is at least as good in almost all those studies, and oftentimes better. How we differ is that we are a public entity. And so we live in a glass house, and everyone can throw stones at us, including ourselves. And we often do. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's what makes us better. And I think that has been the saving grace of the VA system is that we are willing to be open to those types of criticisms. But if I look at my own experiences with my own healthcare system, which is not the VA, unfortunately, there are things that I wish I couldn't let everybody know about that need to be improved. And I don't put that in the paper. I might send that as a comment on a request for feedback, but I don't put it in the paper. But there are lots of not very complimentary facts that are out there.
So one of the things, you know, you're in this bubble where, you know, it's, as you said, not everything's available, but there's some kind of cost containment constrainment to sort of say, look, this is the best value for money. Oncology is getting increasingly expensive, quite prominently because of drugs. If I'm in the VA, do I have access to what you consider the best or cutting edge drugs?
The short answer is yes. And sometimes we have better access. So when durvalumab was first approved for, you know, consolidation after chemo radiation for stage 3, I had one of my colleagues at Duke send me a patient because their insurance company wouldn't cover it and I could get it. So great access to the right drugs. If you want to use a drug in a way that is, I would say, out there, that probably isn't going to fly. And VA does negotiate around prices and can compete for really low drug prices. And we oftentimes have better prices than Medicare. From a clinical practitioner's perspective, it's still a great place to practice because you can get the drugs when they're rationally used.
What about research? So I remember when I first came here, I thought, oh, this is fantastic. We'll open our trials at the VA and, you know, there's this nice captive patient population. It'll be amazing. And it was, you know, this is 15, 20 years ago, it was much, much harder than I thought it was going to be.
Yes. So first of all, I think doing research in another healthcare institution that you're not familiar with is difficult. It's just a whole nother regulation system. But VA has a long history of research. It's always been part of the mission. There have been, you know, some of the first randomized trials were done in the VA.
Yeah.
So the nicotine patch was invented right here in Durham. There is a history of that. But there was a period of time when it became really difficult to do clinical trials in particular, and that came to oncology as well. I think the tide has turned. I think we're going in the right direction now. The cancer moonshots have really helped with that. We do have a way to go.
What were the barriers? I mean, my impression was they were so keen on protecting the veterans as a vulnerable population, almost as if they were kind of like prisoners and they were going to be coerced into doing something. But I wonder if they were doing more harm than good with that protective attitude.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that's exactly what happened. It was so paternalistic, really. It was, you know, we're not going to let the veterans have a choice. about whether they want to take this risk to participate in this trial. That really has, I think, changed completely. I don't hear that at all anymore. If the patient consents to it, then it can happen. But they want to make sure that the veteran is informed. Well, one of, just give you an example is there were information security issues, and they were some very big ones, right? So a few laptops were misplaced that had millions of names, social security numbers on it. And that was just a major problem. And so the VA locked down all the information security. Nothing could come in, nothing could go out. And that impacted research because you can't do research without sharing information, oftentimes with individual identifiers in it. So that became a problem and a barrier, for an example. But there were other barriers as well. I think a lot of the infrastructure went away because it wasn't being used. And VAs in general are not large institutions. They're medium-sized at best, and some of them are small. And so you don't have a large infrastructure of staff to be able to do the research. But some of them do. And now we've really, I think, made a committed effort to do clinical trials for veterans with cancer and to make sure that we can deliver that as close to the veteran as we can possibly do that. So the approach that we're taking is reinvigorating some of the medical centers to be research institutions and to do have clinical trials. We do that of our own accord, but also in collaboration with the National Cancer Institute and with pharmaceutical partners. And we can take clinical trials now and deliver them by telehealth, some clinical trials across the country. And so we can bring research opportunities to veterans that never had that opportunity before.
What clinical trial can you do through telehealth? Non-interventional or?
We do interventional non-therapeutic trials, but we can also do interventional therapeutic trials. The way we have to do those depends on if the drug can be self-administered, like an oral drug or subcutaneous, something of this nature. If it's IV, then that automatically engages the site that would receive the drug in the research, and that means that we have to have a regulatory approval to add that site. But I can enroll patients to a clinical trial from my site through my telehealth connection to them, because that's the way I take care of patients every day, right?
Yeah.
We talk about that. You know, my clinical work is done in other states and not North Carolina. I see patients in South Dakota and Arkansas. I've seen them in West Virginia. I've seen them in Ohio and a little bit in Nevada.
Do you have to have a license in those other states, or is the VA somehow immune from that?
No license needed. And that's why we can do the clinical trials the same way, is because we can cross state lines without any problem.
Wow. I often end these podcasts by asking people what they want to, you know, what they think their kind of, you know, life and work CV is going to be doing in the next 5 years. I think what you've exemplified with the VA is you've got to play the long game. You're clearly making progress at the VA, but in the next 5 years for, you know, Dr. Kelly, what are you going to be working on at the VA? And then, you know, what does Dr. Kelly want to be doing with his life too?
Our vision that came to us in the first Cancer Moonshot in 2016 was that veterans would have access to the same cancer services as they would if they walked in the front door of Memorial Sloan Kettering or MD Anderson or any of the large NCI designated cancer centers. And we are partway there. I think we are able to deliver that to some veterans all the time. And we have some additional services that we're going to set up. So we just launched a clinical cancer genetic service, which is already nationwide. So any veteran that needs any cancer genetic services, we got it, and we have it delivered to them if they need it within a week.
Okay. Do you mean molecular testing of the tumor or like germline checking?
Germline, genetic counseling, all that. We've been doing the tumor testing for a long time. There's a limitation to how many geneticists and genetic counselors there are in the whole country, but we figured out a way that we can get this to everybody all the time when they need it. That's just an example of the type of service. But there are many other services that make up great cancer care, and we're working on all of those. And part of it comes through the different work streams from the Cancer Moonshot. Professionally, I think that's where I'm going. I still want to see that vision advanced. I'm not sure I will ever see it completely instituted, but I think in some ways, the VA will actually hop over some private institutions in terms of certain types of delivery and in ways we already have. In terms of our molecular testing for tumor types, you know, we have a database that has 35,000 patients in it or 35,000 samples in it, and we can query that and find those patients and do all kinds of interesting work both research and clinical care. So new drug comes out, new indication, boom, we're on the wire, telling the patients who potentially are affected, their physicians, hey, there's a new treatment for your patient. Might want to think about this. So we can do that. Okay. Personally, I'm at a point where I'm starting to think of that question in a big sense. I'm not planning to retire anytime soon. I'm very happy with what I'm doing. It does depend on my children to some degree as to what I do next. None of them are married and I don't have any grandchildren. So I'm going to keep working and enjoying them as single adults until that changes. And then I might have some different views on life.
I love it. Mike, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Russ, always great to chat with you. Thank you for having me.